Okay, so we are here moments away from, I mean, we're into Yom Yerushalayim, but moments away from beginning Sefer Bamidbar. We must ask a few questions that would come up. First of all, to understand the difference between life in the desert, life in the Midbar, and life in Eretz Yisrael. We know that we spent 40 years in the desert, right? Was that necessary? What was the purpose of that? So we know the simple understanding was that they were punished because they sinned with the meraglim, with the spies, sending the spies. But seemingly it was necessary, dafka, 40 years, a long time, spending in the desert before the Jewish nation was to enter Eretz Yisrael. What's pshat? What's that all about? Right? So first of all, what's the difference or connection between life in the desert and life in Israel? And second of all, why do we have to spend 40 years in order to get into Israel? Seemingly it was like a prerequisite or a preparation in order to get into Israel. Another question we could ask is that, approaching Shavuot, we know that the Torah was given to us 49 days after we left Israel. Now, 49 days was more than enough time to get into Israel, walking into Israel. It was enough time. We were able to make it. And obviously, even if we weren't able to make it, even if it wasn't, that close of a trip, if it was destined to be, Hashem would make some sort of kfitzat haderech, and we would make it there. We would go into Eretz Yisrael and receive the Torah there. If I would ask you, what's the more appropriate place to receive the Torah? The desert, an area that's empty and desolate, or Eretz Yisrael, our hometown? What would you say? You'd probably say Eretz Yisrael. But no, that was not the case. And the Torah was dafka given to us in the Midbar, in the desert. What's pshat? What's that all about? So in order to understand these things, we need to first understand what the desert was all about. Okay, so once again, we're beginning Sefer Bamidbar tomorrow, this coming Shabbat, in 2 days from now. We're going to be reading, hopefully in a minyan, with 10 men. We're going to be reading Sefer Parashat Bamidbar, beginning Sefer Bamidbar. But even if not, even to those who are, unfortunate, and obviously priority number one is for everyone to stay safe and for everyone to remove themselves from any hazardous areas or any places that are, not just not smart to be at. But we're going to be beginning Sefer Bamidbar. So what's the Midbar? What's the desert all about? So the desert was a place that we were able to see Hashem's hand with absolute clarity. There were miracles upon miracles that were performed just for us in the desert. Just to name a few, we know that the man fell down. The man was the supernatural donut-shaped food that fell down, literally fell down from heaven every single morning. When you woke up in the morning, you walked outside of your tent and it was there. And it tasted like whatever you wanted it to taste. Unbelievable. And it fell down every single morning on a daily basis. Okay? You never had to save any food, stock up on man for in case there was going to be some sort of drought or shortage. You knew beyond the reasonable doubt that there will be more man falling the next day. An unbelievable miracle. Another miracle was the well of Miriam. We know that desert is a place that there are no faucets and there are no Poland Spring bottles for sale. There are no water coolers. So, what are they going to drink? So miraculously, in the Zechut of Miriam, that's why it's called Be'er Miriam, the well of Miriam. There was a fresh spring water flowing from this well in the Zechut and the merit of Miriam, that they were able to drink nice, delicious, tasty water whenever they wanted to. We know there's another miracle was with their clothing. Their clothing did not wear out. It grew with them. If you reached puberty while you were in the Midbar, and you just, went from like 4'2" to 5'7" in a span of a year, then your clothing grew with you. You didn't have to go and make new clothing. That's a miraculous thing. They walked on their feet, and their feet did not become dry or did not get any sores or anything like that from walking on the sand. And miracles upon miracles upon miracles, unbelievable things. The Midbar, the desert, represented and symbolized life, seeing Hashem's hand in open, in complete and absolute clarity. Let's just dig a little deeper over here. There was a nation, this Jewish nation. They were in Egypt. They were worked very, very hard. They were beaten. They were forced into labor. Horrible, horrible things. So what happened was that God sends a messenger to go and tell them, hey, by the way, you know, we're going to get you out of here. All you need to do is just follow me. Okay, where to? Yeah, don't worry. We're going to go into the desert. We'll be all good. We'll receive the Torah, and then we'll go into Israel. But don't worry about it. Everything will be good. We don't really find that the Jews asked any questions. Yeah, you do see by the Yam Suf that they were a little scared. They didn't know where to go. They were surrounded in all directions by wild animals, by the Egyptians behind them, and by the ocean in front of them. That's only because, you know, they were stuck. They had nowhere to go. But generally speaking, when they were asked, hey, do you want to leave Mitzrayim? Yeah, of course we want to leave Mitzrayim. Do you want to follow me into a desert? Yeah, sure, whatever. Did they ask what they're going to eat? What they were going to drink? No, not at all. It was a tremendous display of emunah, of faith, but not only faith, of blind faith. Without asking any questions, going into it blindly, as the Navi says, Ko amar Hashem, so said Hashem, Zacharti la chesed ne'oraych, I remembered, I recall, the kindness that you have done for me at your younger age, meaning younger age referring to the Jewish nation at their younger age, which is right when they came out of Mitzrayim. That's when they were born as a nation. Zacharti la chesed ne'orayach, I recall the amazing kindness you did to me. Lechtech acharai b'midbar be'eretz lo zarua, you followed me into a desert, which was a land that was infertile. You weren't able to plant anything. It's a desert. You can't plant any trees. You can't grow any grass. Right, you can't. Nothing can grow there. There's no survival rate in a desert. You can't survive there, let alone for 40 years. You can't do that. Yet you still followed me into the desert. It made no sense that you did that, but you still did that. Unbelievable display of emunah. Arguably one of the greatest displays of emunah that our nation has ever displayed. Something unbelievable. What happened next? They got into the desert. Now listen, about a month after they left Mitzrayim, so as we know that they had their matzah that they baked at the time of Yetziat Mitzrayim, it lasted them until around a month later. It's actually machloket until when it lasted. So some opinions say it lasted until the 16th of Iyar, and other opinions say it lasted until the 18th of Iyar. What also falls out on the 18th of Iyar? Does anyone know? You could unmute yourself.
No.
18th
it's
of
Sivan,
Iyar.
Sorry.
They came out on Tet Vav on the 15th of Nisan. The following month, on the 18th, a little more than a month later, on the 18th of Iyar, right? All the matzah ran out. They had nothing else to eat. Their food ran out. What was in the 18th of Iyar? It was Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer happens to be Lag BaOmer, right? That's the 33rd day of the Omer. And to that, the Chatam Sofer says, that's the reason why we celebrate on the Omer. What do you mean, reason why we celebrate? That's the day that their matzah finished, their matzah, you know, their whole package of matzot that they brought from Mitzrayim. It ended, they had no more food to eat. Yeah, but what began to fall on the 18th of Iyar? The man began to fall on the 18th of Iyar. So says the Chatam Sofer, tremendous, tremendous source of happiness. The man began to fall. The man began to fall. Hashem took care of us, right? We went in blindly. All we ate was matzah for 32 days. And the day that it ran out, no one was complaining, right? All of a sudden, there were complaints and they were talking about it and they asked Hashem and they davened to Hashem, spoke to Moshe, and Moshe spoke to Hashem and so on and so forth. And then Hashem told Moshe specific instructions about how to eat the man. But whatever, on the 18th of Iyar, the man fell down, right? This food, this edible, delicious food fell from the sky. It wasn't just food. It was a completely spiritual food. The miracles that happened with this man are like too many to count. But undisputedly, the main wonder of this whole concept of the man, the main thing, right? There were so many miracles. It tasted like what you wanted it to taste like. It didn't go bad and unbelievable things. But the main miracle was that they did not have to even lift a finger for 40 years in the desert. And their parnassah and their livelihood was handed to them on a silver platter. Unbelievable. Can you imagine chilling in your tent in the Sinai desert with your kids, just relaxing, you know, coming out onto your, you know, back porch of your tent and just, you know, chilling with your kids the entire day with your family, you know, getting to learn 3 or 4 hours every single day without worrying about what to feed your family, right? Can you imagine such a life, you know, where we wake up in the morning and have absolutely no worries at all in terms of what you're going to put on the table that day or the day after or the day after or the day after? Unbelievable. What an amazing thing. That was the man. The man was this supernatural, miraculous entity that Hashem provided for us that we did not have to even, you know, attempt to do any hishtadlut, any attempt of getting any parnasah at all. What did we do to deserve this? What did we do to deserve such an amazing, miraculous gift that God gave us? What was it? So usually when you get a reward, you know, when you get Hashem gives you, Hashem rewards you for something, it comes as a tailor-made reward that's unique to the action that you have done. What's called in Hebrew, midah keneged midah, measure for measure. You did this specific mitzvah, you're going to get a reward that matches that mitzvah. You did this specific avera, you're going to get punished with a punishment that matches that specific avera that you did. So what was the specific mitzvah that they did in order to get this man? What was it? It was a midah keneged midah that they followed Hashem blindly into the desert, even though it made absolutely no sense. It made no sense for them to follow. Hashem came to the Jews in Egypt and said, follow me. But they didn't ask any questions. They just ran. They had complete emunah that everything would be okay. What about food, water, parnassah? They didn't ask any questions. They just followed Hashem. Where? To a desert. It didn't even sound promising. It made no sense. The point over here is that it made no sense that they should go and follow Hashem into a desert. It was not a logical decision to make. It was above any human comprehension. So midah keneged midah, Hashem took care of them. Hashem took care of us with the man in a rational way. We acted irrationally by having emunah for Hashem. Hashem provided parnassah for us in an irrational way as well. This method of parnassah, that they didn't have to even lift a finger, that their parnassah, their livelihood was not dependent on the amount of work that they did, was not only a reality for that generation. Ladies and gentlemen, I have some news for you guys. It's a reality of each and every single generation until today. Not only in that generation did parnassah come in a wondrous, in a supernatural way. That person's parnassah, that made no sense. But in every single generation, everyone's parnassah makes absolutely no sense. You cannot explain it with words. It's just Hashem's hand. It's just Hashem's hand that was revealed in that generation in an open way, but it's hidden to us in our generation. Your parnassah, ladies and gentlemen, does not depend on the amount of hishtadlut that you're going to put in. How can I prove it? Because if it did, then the one who works the most hours will certainly make the most money, right? But you see, that's not true.
Not true.
How much work you put in. You see, that's not true, right? If it was true, right, then the whole concept of stocks, of betting, of gambling wouldn't be true. Like, it wouldn't make any, it doesn't work like that, right? Why? Because if you invested in this stock and then something happens a month later, you're going to get more money. That had nothing to do with your hishtadlut. That was all luck. How do you explain such a thing? You can't explain that with hishtadlut. It doesn't make sense with hishtadlut. a person's parnasa is directly attributed to Hashem and to nothing else. But since it can't be obvious, Hashem does not want his presence and his hand to be obvious, to be open. So Hashem requires every person to work just enough that it shouldn't be obvious that he's making that money. The more a person buys into this concept, the more wealthy and happy a person will be. Let's take this a step further. I want to read to you the holy words of the Sfas Emes, the Sfat Emet, who is the second Rebbe of the Gera dynasty. Okay, the first one was the Chidush Harim, and the second one was his grandson, the Sfat Emet. An unbelievable Gaon, unbelievable Tzaddik, and tremendous Talmid Chacham. So he writes like this in Parashat Kedoshim just a few parashiot ago. There's something unbelievable. Listen to these words, guys. The only quote that I have for you, actually there's another quote later on, but the only quote from a rabbi that I have for you is this. So he writes, Ki HaKadosh Baruch Hu bara ha'olam b'zeh ha'ofen. Hashem created the world in this way, in this fashion. Shekefi ha'bitul elav mitbarach mitkayem ha'briyah. That as much as a person defers his own will and his own desires to what Hashem says, that's how much wealth he's going to have. That's how much sustenance Hashem will give him. And what's the proof for that? Unbelievable. This proof is something that we live every week. Every single week, we live this proof. What's this proof? He writes, V'ze edut ha-shabbat. The proof of this is a Shabbat. What's the proof from Shabbat? Shebo shovtim mikol ha-ma'asim. The one day a week that you don't work is Shabbat. Yet we find, V'hu kiyum kol yemei ha-ma'aseh. But Shabbat is the source of blessing for the other days of the week. Does that make any sense? That the one day a week that you're not working should be the source? If anything, it should be like a Wednesday, a Thursday, a work day. That should be the source of blessing for the rest of the week. No. Dafka, the one day a week that you're not working. That you're not working. The proof is from Shabbat. It's a day that we don't work. Dafka on this day is the source of blessing for the rest of the week. We say this, Rabbatai, every single Friday night in Kabbalat Shabbat. I hope that everyone will have the zechut of saying this with a minyan this coming Friday night. But it says, Likrat Shabbat lechu v'nelcha, right? In Lecha Dodi, what does it say? Likrat Shabbat lechu v'nelcha. Towards Shabbat, we will surely go. Hi mekora beracha. Excuse me. Because it, Shabbat, is the source of blessing. Shabbat is the source of all blessing. The Aruch Haim HaKadosh says something very scary. The Aruch Haim HaKadosh says, Rav Chaim Ben Attar, the Aruch Haim HaKadosh, he writes that in the creation, when Hashem created the world, so Hashem created Sunday and Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday, those 6 days of creation, Hashem created them, but they only had the ability to exist one time. Sunday, Hashem created Sunday that day, along with the ability to only exist one time. You know, the hope is that this coronavirus will only exist one time and then just go away. The hope is that it's just going to be a one-time thing. And, you know, Bezrat Hashem, it should go away and never come back again. But that's how it was with Sunday and Monday and Tuesday and those days of the week, that it was only created with the ability to survive and to last one time. Came along Shabbat, and Hashem created Shabbat. And what Shabbat did was, Shabbat was the source of all blessing. So Shabbat gave the following Sunday the ability to survive and to exist one more time. And gave the following Monday the ability to exist one more time. And so on and so forth for every day of the week. Right? So it only had the ability to exist one more time until the next Shabbat came. And the next Shabbat gave the following Sunday and Monday and Tuesday the ability to exist one more time. So it comes out that every single Shabbat that we observe is basically the fuel, the gasoline for the following days of the week, the days of the week that follow that Shabbat. It gives them the ability to work and to survive and to prosper. Shabbat is the source of all blessing. I want to tell you a little, share with you a little story. We'll just get sidetracked for a second. Unbelievable story. This is a story that I heard multiple times, multiple different sources. But basically, there was a... 1 second. There was a non-religious Jew that that was a professional cyclist. Okay, he liked bicycling, but you know, he liked doing marathons, and he was one of the top cyclists in Israel at the time. And what happened was that, you know, this was in the early 70s that it happened. And at that point, you know, there was a cycling competition in the Olympics. There was a competition in the Olympics, and he wanted Israel to go and compete in the Olympics, in those Olympics. So what he did was he started gathering together a team of professional cyclists, and they started training. And during that time that they were training, he was ignited by some fire and became religious. He decided to become religious. And one step at a time, obviously, you know, he took certain things upon himself, first the kippah and tzitzit, and then Shabbat, and then kosher food, so on and so forth. But he accepted Shabbat. And he said, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm very religious. I'm going to do this. I want to be religious. I'm inspired. And this is a lifestyle I want to choose. But he also had another interest in life, and that was cycling. And he always wanted to compete in the Olympics. That, you know, that year, when they were having the tryouts for the Olympics, you know, which they trained for months to go and try out in the Olympics, it happens to be that the tryouts fell out on Shabbat. It fell out on Shabbat. For them to go and try to qualify to enter into the Olympics, it was on Shabbat. Now, it's not like today where they have accommodations for people who are religious and so on and so forth. Back then, it wasn't like that. It was on Shabbat. You either come or you don't come. Zero. End of story. He had a big dilemma now. I just started keeping Shabbat. Do I go? Do I not go? He went to his rabbi. What do I do? The rabbi said, listen, you have to do what you feel passionate about, and I can't tell you what to do. By the way, that's a real rabbi. Real rabbis are the ones who don't tell you what to do, the ones who help you make a decision. But anyways, he thought long and hard, spoke to his wife, and he said, you know what? I'm not going to do it. Whatever happens, happens. So he didn't do it. They didn't do the tryouts, and they didn't qualify, and they did not make it to that Olympics. Those Olympics in the early 70s was in the year 1972. The Olympics took place in a city in Germany called Munich. And there was the infamous incident that happened in those Olympics. It's called the Munich Massacre, where a few terrorists, they broke into one of the hotel rooms of the Israeli wrestling team that was competing in the Olympics, and shot to death, I believe, 7 or 8 of those members in those Olympics. A very, very horrifying story. After that news broke out, this cyclist who just started keeping Shabbat and decided not to compete in the Olympics, you know, this thought just popped into his head. He said, if I broke Shabbat to go and to qualify, and we did qualify, and we would make it to the Olympics, we would only be the other Israeli team that would compete in the Olympics along with the wrestling team. Now, if you're a terrorist and you want to go and gun down, you know, Jews, Israelis, Olympian Israelis, would you rather pick on a team of wrestlers or a team of cyclists? Obviously, you'd rather pick on the cyclists. What are they going to do? Pick up their bike and throw it at you? No. You know, they're more prone to being victimized. And right then and there, he thought to himself, and he said, I kept Shabbat. I watched over Shabbat. Shabbat watched over me. And he said that every single time that he went and he biked there on in, he would always sing the words of the holy song that we sing every Friday night, Ki Eshmerah Shabbat El Ishmereni. If I will keep Shabbat, Hashem will keep me. Hashem will watch over me. Shabbat is the source of all blessing. So now, going off the topic of Shabbat for a second, now we can understand this, you know, mysterious halakha that's brought down in Shulchan Aruch that we do every single Friday night and Shabbat day, which is that we have challah on the table. What do we do with the challah? It needs to be covered. That's why when you go to the store, you buy a challah cover. Why did they make up challah covers? Just for fashion, so that the Jewish Judaica stores could make more money and rip you off in a better way? Maybe, maybe. But another reason why is the Shulchan Aruch says that we must cover the challahs every single Friday. And why do we cover the challahs? Listen to this, unbelievable. Covering something hides it. It makes it that you take something that's revealed and you hide it. So why do we do that? Maybe the explanation is that bread symbolizes a person's livelihood. Bread symbolizes a person's parnasa. What do? We cover it. Why do we cover it? We show that a person's livelihood works in very hidden ways. And since Shabbat is the source of all blessing, it makes sense that we cover the bread when? On Shabbat. It only makes sense. Let's take this a step further. The simple reason why we cover the challah, that was a nice reason, but the simple reason is because the challahs represent the man, which was covered when it came down. That's why we have the double lechem mishnah on Shabbat. We always, whenever we make hamotzi on Shabbat, we always make it on two challahs, not one. Why two challahs? Because the man that fell, it didn't fall on Shabbat, it fell on Friday, but a double portion fell on Friday. So we could have some for Friday and some for Shabbat also. And the bread that we eat represents and symbolizes the man that we got, that we received in the midbar. So what do? We cover the bread. Why do we cover the bread? The bread symbolized the man, which was covered when it came down. Now it all makes sense. The man, which sustained the Jews in the desert in a supernatural and a hidden way, what do with it? It was covered. So we also cover the bread, which represents a person's parnasa. Unbelievable. This was the life of a Jew in the desert. Miracles upon miracles upon miracles. However, when they moved into Eretz Yisrael and moved into Israel, there was going to be a big adjustment that they had to figure out. Some things will change and some things will stay the same. What's going to change? A big thing that changed was that now they had to actually go and lay a finger to go and work the land in order to get their parnasah. That changed. That they actually had to go and do ishtadlut now. In the desert, they didn't need to do any ishtadlut. They had to go and actually work to make a living. But what didn't change was Hashem's protection and care for every single Jew. A person will still receive his parnasah in an unbelievable and supernatural way. However, now Hashem wanted everyone to work for it. Hashem instituted that a prerequisite that is necessary in order to access the wealth is that you need to actually work the land. It's just a prerequisite. It's not the cause or the source of your parnasa. It's a technicality that Hashem built into nature. That's why they couldn't just go straight into Israel after they left Mitzrayim. They wouldn't have been prepared to adjust. It would have been too big of a test for their emunah. Think about that. Jumping into Israel, then now it's a goal. It would be very, very hard. Parnasah was going to be provided for them in a hidden way. Would they attribute all of their success to Hashem? Or would they now start to attribute some of their success to their hard work? It was a big test. Like they say, Kochi ve'otzim yadi, right? Would they start to attribute all their success to their hands, to their abilities in their hands? That was the test of going into Eretz Yisrael. It was not easy. And for that, they needed a 40-year-long preparation in the desert. That's the difference between the life in the Midbar, life in the desert, and the life in Israel. Bamidbar, now we can understand why the Torah was given to the Jews in the Midbar, in the desert. Because as Chazal point out, that only if you make yourself like a Midbar, then you're ra'ui, then you're worthy of receiving the Torah. How do you make yourself like a Midbar, like a desert? When you live a life of a Midbar, when you attribute everything around you to Hashem, then you will receive the Torah, then you will acquire the Torah. When a person thinks and bases and depends all of his success on his intellect, and based on his intellect, he goes and learns Torah, and then when he comes up with unbelievable revelations in the Torah, he says, wow, I am so smart, I am so great. That's not a person who will acquire the Torah. That might be a person who will acquire pieces of information and knowledge, but not a person that will acquire the Torah to make the Torah a part of who he is, a part of his identity. You want the Torah to be a part of you. You want Hashem to be a part of you. You need to live a life like a midbar. The Torah had to be given in a desert. You need to act like the Jews did in the desert and attribute everything to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to nothing else. Just to end off, wanna say that tonight marks 53 years since the great, amazing act of kindness that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did for us. As we were reunited with our home, Yerushalayim, it was smack in the middle of yet another miraculous number of days during the Six-Day War. If you don't believe in God, I urge you to read up on the events that led up to the Six-Day War and the events that occurred during the Six-Day War. It's impossible to deny God if you understand what truly happened during that war. In the months leading up to the war, the surrounding countries, they vowed to team up and to destroy all the Jews who lived in Israel and to take over that small strip of land. The Prime Minister of Egypt, his name was Gamal Abdel Nasser. He said that he planned on drinking coffee in Tel Aviv that would have been occupied by him and not by Israel anymore. What happened? The IDF, together with the Air Force, surprised their enemies with a mighty attack which destroyed the armies of Egypt and Syria literally in one day. A truly unnatural occurrence. It didn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense. And then on the third day of the Six-Day War, they didn't even plan to do this, but they saw that in the old city of Yerushalayim, that the Jordanians, they retreated and they weren't really occupying that land anymore. And they saw it as an opportunity. They went, they only heard a few shots from snipers, but that's about it. And, you know, in a very easy way, they went and they conquered and occupied and reoccupied the old city of Yerushalayim, as well as the Kotel and Har HaBayit, which Baruch Hashem, we still have up until today. An unbelievable amount of miracles. You know, we know those famous words said by that soldier, right? HaKotel bi'adenu, Har HaBayit bi'adenu. The Kotel is finally in our hands. And as one of the soldiers reported many, many years later in an interview, he said that, "I'm not a religious Jew at all, but when I saw the Kotel, I started crying." He said, "I have no affiliation with Judaism, only the fact that I'm Israeli and maybe with the Israeli culture, but nothing more than that. But when I saw the Kotel, I couldn't deny the miracles upon miracles that happened leading up to this. And I couldn't deny the holy presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that I felt at that moment in that location." Yitzhak Rabin, we all know him. He summed up this entire war in seven words. Now, Yitzhak Rabin, if I, you know, could tell you, he also was not someone, it was not a religious person. Yet, when he was asked to sum up, the story happened that he was supposed to be at an interview with Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Livracha, the former chief rabbi of Israel, and he didn't make it to the interview. So the person who was going to interview him with Rav Mordechai Eliyahu said, "All right, at least, you know," and the interview was supposed to be about the Six-Day War. He said, "At least give us, you know, one little sentence to summarize, you know, your view about the Six-Day War and what happened." He summed it up in seven words, guys. Seven words. Me'et Adonai hayta zot hiniflat be'enenu. From Hashem, this happened, and it was a wonder in our eyes. He couldn't deny Hashem's presence in a revealed way during the Six-Day War. And that's what we celebrate tonight and tomorrow, which is what's called Yom Yerushalayim, the day that we reconquered, reoccupied the old city of Yerushalayim, which we still have until today. It's a day that Hashem fed us a small taste of what life used to be like in the Midbar. Open miracles. But then he brought us into the land of Israel. He brought us into Eretz Yisrael. And now, and the time after that, and today, is our true test. Can we attribute our success as individuals, as a nation, to Hashem? Can we attribute that success to Hashem? Can we attribute all the advances in technology and inventions that have come out from that small little strip of land, from Jews all around the world? Can we attribute that success to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Can we attribute the mighty, mighty army that we have built for ourselves to Hashem? Can we do that? Can we pass the test? Or are we going to fail the test? Are we going to continue to think that it's all a result of us and our efforts and nature and society and so on and so forth? The true lesson of Sefer Bamidbar is to understand that the same way in the desert, when miracles were out in the open, our goal was to recognize Hashem's open miracles and Hashem in a revealed way. So too, that is our mission in life going into Israel after the desert, and that is our mission in life today, to try to recognize and crown Hashem over every single aspect of the creation. That's Yom Yerushalayim. So it's a day that we have a little taste of what life used to be like in the Midbar. A day that was, you know, not even arguably, was definitely one of the most miraculous days, and you know, in modern history, you know, worldwide history, not only Jewish history. You know, can we look at that and attribute it to Hashem and continue to attribute every single moment in our lives to Hashem? That's the goal, that's our mission. And approaching Shavuot, which is next week, Matan Torah, to take that Torah that Hashem gave us in a revealed way. Hashem came down. Hashem never revealed himself in such a way. To take that inspiration and revelation. And the goal is not just that one day to try to always bring Hashem down, try to always have open miracles. The goal is to take those miracles with us, carry it with us into the day-to-day, into the daily lives where it's a little harder to find Hashem. When we're in the workplace, when we're studying for finals, when we're talking to our children, when we're talking to our parents, to our siblings, to feel Hashem with us at all times, that miracles upon miracles are happening to us and to our family members. That is the mission and the goal that we have to try to pass during these days. I thank everyone for listening. I would love to hear questions, comments, feedback. And if not, I would love for you to just say hello or goodbye.
Chazak Baruch, Rabbi. It was beautiful.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Thank you.